well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me today. I am flying solo. You're going to keep me company today. But we're going to talk about a new filing out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And this relates to something that we've talked a lot about this week, actually, the DOJ's position on Second Amendment cases and the criticism by some groups like GOA that the DOJ is not taking as pro-2AA stance as they would like. We've seen pushback from Assistant Attorney General Harmy Dillon, who's talked about the efforts that the DOJ is doing to protect the Second Amendment, and her explanation about some of these NFA-related cases, and even the Reese versus ATF case, which involves handgun sales to 18 to 20-year-olds, is that, you know, essentially, well, particularly on the NFA cases, she says, you know, listen, there's no circuit court split here. So she was talking about a case called the Rush versus ATF, right? This is a case dealing with short-barreled rifles. Cert petition has been filed with the Supreme Court. DOJ's position is that the Supreme Court should not take this case, not only because there's no circuit split. If that was the entirety of the argument, again, I think there'd be some grumbling from Second Amendment organizations, but there wouldn't be criticism of the DOJ's position. The DOJ's position is not just that there's no circuit court split, but that the NFA is constitutional and that restrictions on short-barreled rifles are fine and dandy under the Second Amendment. So we've got this other case that's in the Fifth Circuit. It's called Peterson versus ATF. It deals with suppressors. And we've discussed this case on the program several times before with Knox Williams from American Suppressor Association and others. George Peterson convicted of possessing an unregistered suppressor. He has argued that the NFA, when it comes to suppressors anyway, is unconstitutional, at least as it is applied to him. A district court judge denied Mr. Peterson's claims. A three-judge panel on the Fifth Circuit denied Mr. Peterson's claims. And now Peterson's attorneys are asking the Fifth Circuit en banc to review his case. The government filed a brief this week objecting to that motion and arguing that the Fifth Circuit panel got it correct. Now, the DOJ's position has changed in this case. In March, which admittedly was just a couple of months after, you know, Donald Trump was sworn in for a second term, so you could say that the DOJ was in a transition period at that point. But back in March of this year, the DOJ took the position that suppressors are not protected by the Second Amendment, so you can do whatever the hell you want with them, as far as, you know, set up rules and regulations, laws and statutes. There were complaints by Second Amendment groups at that time, and the DOJ withdrew that motion and submitted another motion to the Fifth Circuit three-judge panel saying, okay, suppressors, we've reconsidered our position in light of Donald Trump's executive action on Second Amendment issues, and we, the DOJ, now conclude that suppressors do, in fact, enjoy some protection under the Second Amendment. However, the $200 tax stamp and the registration requirements of the National Firearms Act are allowable, even though these are Second Amendment protected items, because they impose a modest burden on the purchase and possession of not a firearm itself, but an accessory. And the three-judge panel, without deciding whether or not suppressors are protected under the Second Amendment, upheld Peterson's conviction, upheld the NFA's taxation and registration requirements, comparing them to a shall-issue concealed carry licensing system, even though that's not the case, right? This isn't a licensing system. This is a tax that is imposed on the purchase of an item that the government contends is protected by the Second Amendment. Any requirement that individuals who lawfully purchase one of these items have to register that item with the federal government. When you become a licensed concealed carry holder, in the vast majority of states, there is no registration component. It is possible that you can have a concealed carry license and not be a gun owner, right? So there, and now I will say in a handful of states like California, you do have to state, here's the gun I intend to carry, and you are permitted only to carry certain firearms, those that you have listed, right? But that's, again, that's an outlier law, and what I would say that is completely contrary to the national tradition of firearms ownership in this country. So the DOJ, again, has reversed course. It now says that suppressors are protected under the Second Amendment, at least to some degree. But those protections do not preclude you having to pay a $200 tax and register suppressors under the NFA. So now we get to this brief that was filed, or this motion that was filed this week, asking the Fifth Circuit to not take this case en banc. Before we get into the actual meat of this motion here, I will tell you what Knox Williams from the American Suppressor Association had to say. He said that the assistant U.S. attorney, the acting assistant U.S. attorney who filed this brief, has, quote, once again demonstrated that he has no understanding of suppressors or the Second Amendment. To claim that a federal gun registry is a modest restriction that does not violate the constitutional rights of law-abiding Americans is gaslighting at best. To make that claim amid a government shutdown during which NFA applications are not being processed, a clear violation of the Second Amendment, is an irony that cannot be overlooked. And that the fact of the matter is simple. Federal gun registries violate the Second Amendment. As Assistant U.S. Attorney Simpson has acknowledged in previous briefs, suppressors are protected by the Second Amendment. They are not non-essential accessories. They are a protected device in common use that millions of law-abiding Americans use to safeguard their hearing. Suppressors are not, quote, uniquely adaptable to criminal misuse. They are uniquely essential to preserving one of the five senses while exercising our Second Amendment rights. And to argue otherwise is to spread blatant misinformation. Okay, so that's the response, which is, and by the way, if we, we'll probably be talking more about this with Knox, hopefully on Monday's program. So let's get into this brief itself, which, as Knox Williams says, was filed by Michael Simpson, the acting U.S. attorney, there in Louisiana. All right. So he writes, defendant appellant George Peterson asked this court to reconsider its decision holding that the National Firearms Act's prohibition on the possession of unregistered suppressors does not violate the Second Amendment. The panel correctly held that the NFA's modest restrictions, and there we go, modest restrictions on suppressor possession do not violate the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. He says this decision does not conflict with any decisions of this court, the Supreme Court, or any other court of appeals. Further, Peterson's disagreement with various aspects of the panel's reasoning does not warrant en banc review. The court should deny the petition. Okay, so once again, we are talking about, and we see the DOJ taking the position that a $200 tax applied specifically to the purchase of NFA items, in this case suppressors, is not a violation of our right to keep and bear arms, and in fact only imposes a, quote, modest burden, right? Going later in the brief, Simpson writes and kind of reiterates that a point that he made in his introductory paragraph. As the government's earlier filing explained, the NFA imposes only a modest burden on the possession of suppressors. The NFA's restrictions are consistent in both their how and why with historical laws regulating weapons that were particularly susceptible to criminal misuse. Bruin, he adds, endorsed other similarly modest schemes, such as shall issue license to carry laws. The panel here, talking about the three-judge panel, analogized to shall issue licensing laws to uphold the NFA's application to Peterson's conduct. They did. Again, I don't think that was an accurate comparison, but the DOJ likes that panel's decision, so it more than happy to say, yeah, that's an appropriate analogy to use. Simpson goes on to say that Peterson mostly argues that the panel improperly conflated the NFA's registration requirement and tax with a mere licensing scheme that charges a fee. However, Simpson says, the panel did not hold that the NFA's registration and taxation requirements is equivalent in every way to a license to carry regime that charges a fee. Instead, he says, the panel reasoned that, like shall issue license to carry laws, the NFA does not outright prohibit suppressor possession, but rather merely conditions possession on proper criteria. Additionally, the panel reasoned that Peterson had not shown that the NFA's $200 tax operated to, quote, deny him his Second Amendment rights. Nothing in the panel's decision conflicts with the Supreme Court's decision regarding unconstitutional taxation. So, you know, again, we get back to Assistant Attorney General Harmy Dillon talking about, you know, listen, there's no circuit court split over the constitutionality of the NFA. which is fair enough. But that's not the issue here, right? The issue that gun control, or the Second Amendment groups have is that there should be a circuit court split, and the DOJ should not be defending the NFA, should not be pointing to the lack of a circuit court split. The DOJ should perhaps be trying to create a circuit court split by arguing, or at least not defending the NFA statutes. Interestingly, though, Peterson's attorneys argue that there is a circuit court split because the Third Circuit in Coons versus New Jersey, this is the case dealing with one of the cases dealing with New Jersey's post-brew and carry laws. Third Circuit has mostly upheld those laws, but it did say that a state law that imposed an additional $50 fee for handgun carry permits that was supposed to go to a crime victim compensation fund was likely unconstitutional. And that, again, would be a special fee, not necessarily a tax, but a special fee that is applied to the exercise of our Second Amendment rights. Whereas the Fifth Circuit panel said these special taxes, akin to a licensing fee, are perfectly fine. The assistant U.S. attorney says that that's not correct, that there is no circuit court split, that the reasoning and outcome in Coons do not conflict with the panel's decision here, saying that Coons did not involve the National Firearms Act, but rather an entirely different state law. Now, I have to point out, the DOJ's position, they're fine pointing to concealed carry licensing laws to defend the statute in some circumstances, but they don't want to compare the NFA to state-level licensing laws for concealed carry in other circumstances. Yeah, I find that inconsistency worth noting anyway. Simpson says, also, Coons involved a burden on the public carry of handguns, the, quote, quintessential self-defense weapon, quoting District of Columbia versus Heller. Whereas this case, he writes, involves suppressors, useful but non-essential firearm, a useful but non-essential firearm accessory. Further, he writes, the victim compensation fee in Coons was enacted in 2022 in direct response to Bruin, the holding of which made clear that New Jersey's may issue handgun licensing schemes like the New York licensing scheme invalidated in Bruin would violate the Second Amendment. The NFA, by contrast, is a 90-year-old law passed under Congress's taxing power and was not enacted in response to and with intent to nullify a Second Amendment protective precedent from the Supreme Court. Peterson cannot show any direct conflict with Coons. Now, I don't think that really matters, that the NFA wasn't established for the same reason that New Jersey's post-Bruin licensing laws were established. By the way, I apologize if you can hear Mario the Rooster clucking away in the background. I don't know what's got him so hot and bothered right now. Maybe it's this case. Who knows? Anyway, I don't think it matters that the reason for those things were different. In fact, I would argue that the reason why the NFA was imposed was, in fact, to make it impossible for the average American to buy these restricted items. And the $200 tax stamp in 1934 was a lot more cost prohibitive than $200 is today. And we see Democrats and other gun control activists who have argued that the NFA fee should be raised, that $200 is not enough, that it should be $5,000, $6,000 per NFA item. And there's nothing in the NFA that would stop Congress from passing another law that would raise those fees. So it may, even if, and I don't concede that $200 is a modest burden, but even if you want to make that argument that, well, a $200 tax stamp is a modest burden today, it certainly wasn't a modest burden at the time that the law was enacted, and it was not intended to be a modest burden at the time that the law was enacted. There's also an issue here with this sort of two-tiered system of Second Amendment protections that Simpson is offering here. The Supreme Court hasn't said that, you know, some arms that are protected by the Second Amendment are more protected by the Second Amendment than other arms that are protected by the Second Amendment. The Supreme Court has said bearable arms that are in common use for lawful purposes are protected by the Second Amendment. And the DOJ's position is that suppressors are protected by the Second Amendment. So I don't think that there's any precedent from the Supreme Court or any other courts that would suggest, again, that some Second Amendment protected items have more protection than others. That's not what the Supreme Court has said, but that's essentially the position that the DOJ is taking here. Simpson's motion goes on to say that Peterson claims this case presents the exceptionally important question of how far the federal government may go in making the exercise of a fundamental right difficult, costly, and ultimately punishable by criminal law. The questions the panel resolved, however, he says, are narrower than Peterson claims. The NFA regulation at issue does not target ordinary firearms such as handguns, but only non-essential firearm accessories that are uniquely adaptable to criminal misuse. Law-abiding citizens remain free to possess suppressors so long as they register them. Also, recent legislative changes mitigate Peterson's taxation concerns. Effective January 1st, there will be no taxation on making and transferring suppressors to the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Fair enough. But again, that language can expire, right? And this was passed through budget reconciliation. It can be removed through budget reconciliation. And again, we see this notion that some items are more protected than others. There's nothing, again, in Supreme Court precedent that would suggest that's the case. As for Simpson's claim that items that are especially uniquely adaptable to criminal misuse, well, Peterson has raised the argument that would open up the door to a $200 or more tax on handguns, which of course are the firearm most commonly used in crime. Simpson addresses this. He says the panel decision would not allow the government to, quote, impose taxation and registration requirements on every privately owned firearm in the nation, as Peterson claims. As the government's previous filing made clear, registration laws or taxes on ordinary firearms would trigger a different analysis because such laws would impose a more severe burden on the right to keep and bear arms. Further, the panel's decision was not as far-reaching as Peterson claims. The panel made clear that it should decide only that Peterson had failed to develop and blah, 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 blah. Again, there's no such thing as ordinary arms protected by the Second Amendment and extraordinary arms protected by the Second Amendment. There are arms protected by the Second Amendment. And if the DOJ's position is that, well, arms that are protected by the Second Amendment but are uniquely adaptable to criminal misuse can be restricted, can be taxed, it can require registration, can have additional restrictions that are designed to have an impact on the acquisition and possession of those items because they are uniquely adaptable to criminal misuse, then why wouldn't that apply to handguns, which are the arm most commonly used in violent crime? The government doesn't say why it would not apply, just that it wouldn't apply, that some different standard would be used. Well, what standard would that be? And why would it be different? I don't know that Simpson can answer that question. If he could, maybe he would have included that in the brief. So I'm not impressed with that logic. Now listen, I'm not an attorney, and if there's an attorney watching who says, Cam, listen to this, and Cam, you're wrong, and here's why, let me know. But to me, Peterson's arguments carry weight. They are valid. Because the DOJ's position, at least in my opinion, and I've been covering Second Amendment litigation for over 20 years, has no basis in Supreme Court precedent. And instead would create this weird tiered system of protection where maybe handguns are more protected than suppressors. All right, well, where do semi-automatic rifles fall into that? The government has taken the position that so-called assault weapons are protected by the Second Amendment. The large-capacity magazines are protected by the Second Amendment. But gun control groups say that large-capacity magazines and so-called assault weapons are uniquely adaptable to criminal misuse. So could an AR-15 be placed under the NFA, according to this standard that Simpson is raising here? Could magazines that can hold 20 rounds of ammunition be subject to NFA restrictions? Are they less protected than magazines that can hold 10 rounds? Again, there's nothing that the Supreme Court has said in Heller, McDonald, Catano, Bruin, Rahimi, that would suggest that we can have these sorts of levels of protection for bearable arms. I don't know where Simpson's coming up with this. I don't know if Maine Justice approved the arguments here. But I think Knox Williams is right when he says that to claim that a federal gun registry is a modest restriction that doesn't violate the constitutional rights of law-abiding Americans is gaslighting at best. And, you know, his point about the government shutdown, putting a halt to processing NFA applications, I think it is only proves that point. Again, DOJ has acknowledged that suppressors are protected by the Second Amendment. You can't buy one today. I mean, you can plunk down your money, but the ATF isn't processing Form 4 applications. That's not an essential part of what the ATF does, apparently. Now, law enforcement and the military, sure, but civilians, no. So is the DOJ taking a position that your Second Amendment, your access to at least some items protected by the Second Amendment can be curtailed completely through government inaction without actually violating your Second Amendment rights? Even though, again, we're talking about items that are protected by the Second Amendment. Once again, it makes no sense. I appreciate the DOJ reversing itself and taking the position that suppressors are protected by the Second Amendment. However, that distinction means nothing if it's protected in name only. And that seems to be the case. That the DOJ's position is that, well, as long as they're not banned outright, you can do anything you want with these protected arms. And that these protected arms are somehow different than other arms that are protected. That is a dangerous, dangerous argument to make. And even if the DOJ does not intend for some of the consequences that could arise from such an argument, you don't think that there are going to be anti-gun jurisdictions that would have a field day with what the DOJ is claiming here? And say, oh, well, yeah, I mean, okay, well, if that applies to suppressors, it applies to 20-round magazines, applies to semi-automatic long guns, applies to whatever it is that they're trying to restrict. Anyway, I hope that we will talk with Knox Williams about this some more on Monday's Bearing Arms Cam and Company. But again, I think it is, I've reiterated this position all along. I'll say it once again. The DOJ is doing historic work to defend the Second Amendment. It is also, however, taking steps to defend federal gun control laws that I believe violate the Constitution. So is this the most pro-2A DOJ in modern history? Yup. Is there room for improvement? Yup. Is there need for improvement? I would say also, yup. But we'll continue this conversation going forward. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day. And our recidivist report, we'll start there with a case out of Kansas. This from Lawrence Journal World. I knew that there was another word in there that I was forgetting. Headline, in liquor store assault, repeat felon's plea agreement filed under seal. DA agrees to no finding that a gun was used, recommends probation. Yeah, anytime you got a plea deal filed under seal so the public shouldn't be able to access it, I mean, that's a red flag in and of itself, right? So kudos to the Lawrence Journal World for covering this story. Kim Callahan's the reporter here. She writes that the Douglas County DA's office cut a plea deal on Wednesday with a repeat felon who was accused of trying to rob a woman at gunpoint at a liquor store, agreeing that there would be no finding that a firearm was used, dropping two other felony charges, not objecting to the man's GPS monitor being removed in the months before he'll be sentenced, and recommending that he be given probation. Callahan calls the plea agreement filed under seal unusual and notes that the judge said it would remain under seal until she gave an order to unseal it. Callahan asked Assistant DA Cody Smith why the plea agreement was sealed, and he said he would have to ask his supervisor before providing any information. As she writes, if the Journal World had not been present at Wednesday's hearing, little would be known about the outcome of Pope's cases. A 44-year-old originally charged with attempted aggravated robbery and aggravated assault for an incident back on March the 4th. Additionally, allegedly put on a mask and aggressively demanded money from a person at Buddy's Liquor in Lawrence, Kansas. In both charges, he was accused of brandishing a firearm. There's a separate case from December of 2024 where he was accused of felony theft of a bicycle worth more than $1,500. On Wednesday, Pope pleaded no contest to one count of aggravated assault. All the other felony charges were dismissed. And again, the state agreed to a finding that agreed to no finding that a gun was used. If a defendant uses a firearm in the commission of a personal felony, there's a Kansas law known as Special Rule 1 that presumes a prison sentence will be imposed. But as Callahan writes, prosecutors sometimes agree to the legal fiction that no gun was used as a bargaining tool in order to sidestep that special rule. In one recent case, she writes, the DA's office referred to a gun not as a firearm, but as a, quote, inherently dangerous item or object in order to achieve the outcome that no gun was used. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. She writes that Pope presumably would have faced a prison sentence between 27 to 31 months. But again, probation, right, is what he's getting. And I don't think he's got to go back to court until December 2nd for a status conference. And again, he's free to be without GPS monitoring. I mean, admittedly, we've seen crimes committed by people who are on GPS monitoring. So whatever. I guess, again, if you decided that the guy is only going to get probation, why monitor him to make sure that he's actually abiding by the terms of his probation? I mean, you've cut him already such a sweetheart deal. Unreal. It's just an unreal sentence to me. And again, apparently not the first time that we've seen something like this in Douglas County, Kansas. Kudos to Kim Callahan for covering the story. We all complain about media, both national and local, but as somebody who started out his reporting career covering cops and courts, I do have a special place in my heart for reporting on criminal justice issues and the reporters that do a good job of reporting on these abuses, which take place every day. So really, kudos to Kim Callahan of the Lawrence Journal World for some excellent reporting here. On to today's, armed citizen story from North Carolina, where cops say a break-in turned chaotic when some neighbors interrupted and ended up being shot at. The Charlotte Observer describes this as a gunfight ensuing, but it was actually more of shots being fired and then shots being fired in self-defense. I guess it's a gunfight. I don't know. Gunfight just makes it sound like, you know, people took the law into their own hands and like, both sides were wrong here. I don't think that's the case. It happened in Cleveland County, North Carolina. The sheriff's office said it happened just before 11 p.m. This past Monday, October 13th, at a rural home northwest of the small town of Grover. Sheriff's office said the homeowner went outside, noticed lights on an adjacent home that was being remodeled, and the homeowner was aware that the lights should not be on and suspected a break-in and entering. So went over to check it out. It got confronted by a male suspect. Sheriff's office says the male suspect then shot at the homeowner. Thankfully, it doesn't sound like the homeowner was hit. A neighbor heard the gunshots, comes running out of his home to check on the commotion. The neighbor also encountered a male subject, according to the sheriff's department, and the neighbor shot at the male after it appeared to him that the male was preparing to shoot at him. That, in turn, prompted the suspect to run away. He was last seen driving away in an Audi. No plate information or anything, but it very well could have been stolen at this point. Officials say currently we don't have any confirmation that anyone was injured. The matter is still under investigation. The search for the occupants of the Audi continues. I'm glad to know that the neighbors who were looking out for the homeowner there, who wasn't around, uninjured, and hopefully an arrest is made here. But yeah, I wouldn't call this a gunfight. I would call this a defensive gun use, but that phrase, strangely, hasn't caught on among mainstream media outlets. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A Florida man who raised $4,000 to help a homeless man find housing. This is just one of those stories, you know, just got me right in the feels anyway. John Ferber said he was inspired by seeing a video on social media. So there you go. One positive thing about social media, I guess. He spotted a guy named Peter Martin sitting on a bus stop bench several months ago, and he just decided to walk up to him and start talking. He said, I had some free time and decided to grab some Chinese food. He said, I drove up to Peter, and sure enough, he was on the bench where I thought he would be, and we had a great conversation. So Peter Martin, who I think is 67 years old, has been homeless, lost his job back in 2023, and soon after lost his place to live. Martin said, I've gone through a lot, days and days, 5, 6, 7 days without eating at times. So Ferber decided, you know what, I'm going to just start a GoFundMe. Obviously make a donation himself, but to see if he could find a studio apartment for Martin. And he was able to raise about $4,000 pretty quickly, which was enough, obviously, for a deposit and to put Martin in that apartment. He actually moved in yesterday, and he celebrated his 67th birthday on Monday. He said, it was my birthday, and John Ferber pulled up. He said he hit me with that big gift, and he said, you know, never in my life has anybody been that forthcoming and gracious and hospitable, giving generously. For the past couple of years, Martin has suffered two heart attacks, but he is hoping now that his housing situation is stable that he can soon get back to work. He was a chef before, and he says, I hope to get the job and use what I've been using for 45 to 50 years as far as skill and knowledge and bring some value to a business. As for John Ferber, he told Peter, I love you. Said, I want the best for you. I believe in you. Said, I know that this is the first step to the best next year and the rest of your life. He said, I'm glad you're not on that bench anymore, and I'm here with you. So, in the right place. And by the way, another $1,000 has been raised for Peter since this story first appeared in local media. This was WPTV. In Florida, covering what John Ferber did. And, you know, again, this isn't the same as pulling somebody out of a burning home or rescuing somebody from a the floodwaters when they're about to be swept away in their car. This is a different kind of being in the right place at the right time and doing the right thing, right? Seeing somebody in need, reaching out, getting to know more about them, and doing what you can to help them get back on some solid footing. I think that is an act of heroism in its own way. And so, John Ferber, we certainly thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program, as always. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again on Monday. Again, hopefully we'll be talking with Knox Williams about this Fifth Circuit decision, but there may be something else that pops between now and then. If so, we will certainly have it covered for you at BearingArms.com. I encourage you to check out the website between now and Monday. But we'll also be hitting the latest 2A news for you on Monday's program as well. Also, I'll be joining Mark Walters on Armed American Radio Sunday Night Monster Cast, I believe in the 8 o'clock hour Eastern time. Might be the 9 o'clock hour Eastern time. Anyway, you need to be listening to the whole show anyway. So check me out there Sunday night. I also mentioned earlier this week, I put out a song in honor of Miss E. You can find it on all the major streaming platforms, Spotify, iTunes. It's on YouTube as well. Check it out if you get time. I'm pretty proud of it. And Miss E's birthday is coming up next week, so I want to do something special to honor her memory. So there you go. Have a great weekend, great rest of your week, and we'll see you back here soon. Until then. Be well, be safe, and be free.